So thanks. Is the microphone working okay? Okay, great. So first, before I start, I'd like to thank the physics department for inviting me here and letting me tour around and talking to me. I've had a lot of nice discussions today, and in particular, I'd like to thank Ken for inviting me and arranging this trip. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about our work on tunable terahertz metamaterials. And so before I start, I want to acknowledge my collaborators. So they come from mostly all over the country, although we do have an international collaborator. A number of people from Los Alamos, including John O'Hara and Hao Tong Chen, who basically have done a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about. Boston College, Willie Padilla's group, Boston University, Rick Averett. We have a collaboration with David Smith and company at Duke, with Weili Zhang's group at Oklahoma State, with Egal Brenner and company at Sandia. They're also part of our Center for Integrated Nanotechnologies. We get some of our samples from Art Gossard's group at UC Santa Barbara. We have a collaboration with Chris Holloway at NIST. Roland Kirsten's group has done some near-field imaging for us at University of Munich, and Dan Middleman at Rice University. So this is my outline. Basically, I'll start off telling you a little bit about electromagnetic metamaterials and why you would want to be interested in them. Then I'll talk about what is called the terahertz gap. This is basically the lack of technology to do optical measurements in the terahertz regime. And then finally, I'll describe our solution to this terahertz gap, which is basically to develop metamaterials to develop active photonic devices in that area. Then I'll summarize. So why would one be interested in metamaterials? So this is a motivational slide here. When the super collider, which was this big high energy physics facility, was canceled, a colleague of mine who actually was here for a couple of years, Melissa Franklin, was interviewed about, you know, what was the physics community giving up when the super collider was canceled. And her response was, you know, in terms of Star Trek, we're giving up the transporter. You won't be able to beam me up anymore. So in terms of metamaterials, there is an application that's also present in the Star Trek series, and that's the cloak. And so, yeah, I don't know if you can really see it, but this is a bird of prey coming to life. And this is actually much closer to reality than, say, the transporter is, I would say. For those of you who are young undergraduates and really don't know Star Trek, this is the same as an invisibility cloak of Harry Potter's. And I just want to finish this motivational slide by quoting, this is actually the first line in the new BSAC, Basic Energy Sciences Advisory Council, report on directing matter and energy, five challenges for science and the imagination. And basically it says, it is frequently said that any advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Okay, so back to reality. What are electromagnetic metamaterials? Well, these are basically artificially constructed materials where their electromagnetic properties derive from their sub-wavelength structures, not from the material that they're made of. So you're able, with these materials, as I will show, to tune the value of the dielectric constant, or the frequency-dependent dielectric constant, and the permeability, so affect the electric response and the magnetic response of a material, and get things like negative index of refraction. This enables phenomena that are qualitatively different than one finds in normal materials, such as negative refraction. And I'll show you a demonstration of this. The ability to focus below the diffraction limit, and as David Smith has both suggested theoretically and shown theoretically, electromagnetic cloaking. Yeah? Oh, sure. Okay. So the field of metamaterials really blossomed with the suggestion of John Pendry of the magnetic split ring resonator that really has a tunable magnetic response. So basically, this consists of two concentric rings with capacitive gaps opposing one another. You basically thread it through. So if this is your material, you thread it through with a magnetic field. It causes oscillating currents that then, if they're tuned to the appropriate frequency, resonate. Okay, so you get this resonant response that's shown here. The resonance frequency is basically tunable by the dimensions. Thanks. By the dimensions of your split ring resonator, and these are basically act like little atoms in that you use this in an approximation where the wavelength of light covers many of these little structures. So you basically built up an artificial magnetic material in this case. One can also tune the permittivity of a material. One can simply do this by using different metals where you basically have a plasma frequency typically in the UV or the visible. If you use metallic wires, by tuning the carrier density and the electron mass, you basically can tune the plasma frequency to lower frequencies. Or you can actually, as suggested again by John Pendry, use cut wires so that you get a tunable response, which again depends on the dimensions of your material. More conveniently, you can tune the electric response in an artificial material using standard fabrication techniques like as was shown for the split ring resonator, which has a magnetic response. So the way to do this is to take two split ring resonators, combine them together so that if you excite this with an electric field basically perpendicular to the gap, you get these two opposing currents, so there's no magnetic response in the far field, but there is an electric response. And the electric response basically is tunable by tuning the dimensions of these little electric atoms. So this basically shows the current distribution and the charge distribution or the electric field distribution in this particular material. It's really acting like a LRC circuit, which is how you can actually model the response. And again, we are in a regime where we have a lot of these little electric atoms within the wavelength of light. So we're in the effective medium approximation here. So the first negative refractive index material was demonstrated in the microwave. This was an experiment that was carried out by David Smith and Willie Padilla. These are the split ring resonators, which are really macroscopic. This is using basically circuit technology, and they were able to measure directly a negative index of refraction in that this is where the wave would be diffracted using just a piece of Teflon, and this is the negative index material or left-handed material had a negative angle for the diffraction. So Since this first demonstration in 2000, the field has progressed pretty far, and near-infrared metamaterials have been demonstrated. This particular structure, which is now the scale of which is nanometers, not centimeters, okay, it has a response that is submicron. So we're really pushing to the near-infrared and towards the visible with metamaterials. So this is actually, that's my background on metamaterials. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the terahertz region of the spectrum and why that's an interesting region. So the terahertz region has a lot of promising applications. So in the area of spectroscopy, you can actually get spectral signatures from things like explosive materials that one might want to sense for various applications. You also can look at the rotational spectra of various molecules, say pollutants or proliferants. There's also applications in imaging in that a lot of materials like wrapping materials or cover materials, wood, foam, plastics, you can see through using terahertz radiation. So it makes it a good kind of probe for non-destructive evaluation. So this is an example of terahertz imaging in an energetic material, PBX. And this is actually the kind of image that they look for you know, say at an airport in a millimeter wave based or terahertz wave based imaging system. And actually, I came through one of these when I came here. There's one in the Albuquerque airport. So the problem with terahertz is that there aren't a lot of active materials that you can use to develop devices, okay? It is basically at the intersection of microwave, where you use electronic techniques, and the IR visible, where you use photonics, okay? Materials are lacking here. There aren't materials with resonances, either electric or magnetic, in the terahertz regime, and this causes basically a lack of sources, detectors, polarizers, modulators. You have it. You don't have active materials in this region. So I've told you about metamaterials, and I've told you about the terahertz regime. Now I'm going to tell you about our solution to the terahertz regime, which is basically to use metamaterials. If you take metamaterials, and these are electric metamaterials, with parameters such that the unit cell is about 50 microns in size, you've got gaps of a couple of microns. These are really pretty easy to fabricate using standard photolithography techniques. However, they also show a response in the terahertz. So this particular device with these dimensions, this is the current, the electric field, and this actually shows that there's a resonance in the terahertz regime. This is a transmission, electric field transmission, and this is the dielectric function. So this resonance, basically, that's caused by the metamaterial enhances the interaction with terahertz radiation and enables us to produce things like active modulators, active filters, and even potentially sensors in the terahertz regime. So before I go on and tell you about the different devices that we've developed using metamaterials, and I want to tell you a little bit about our measurement technique, because that's really essential. So in order to do these measurements, we are using a technique that's called time domain terahertz spectroscopy. And I know that several labs here have implemented this kind of a setup for various diagnostics. It's very nice because it enables you both to measure. It's a coherent detection technique that you do in the time domain, and it allows you to measure both the amplitude and the phase of your terahertz, terahertz radiation passing through a sample. So basically what you do is you take, a time domain signal through the sample. You compare it to a reference. You basically calculate the complex transmission function, which enables you to, for the particular sample, get out the amplitude and the phase of the transmission characteristics. And from that, you can fully extract the dielectric properties over this frequency regime. So that's shown here. So this is our basic characterization technique. And it's very convenient because it enables us to get both amplitude and phase, or real and complex dielectric functions. So first, we've actually, starting with the basics, developed a set of metamaterials that you can use in the terahertz regime that have different functions. So shown here are a variety of metamaterials that actually exhibit they basically serve as filters in the terahertz regime, in that you can get a tunable resonance. The first two have twofold symmetry, and those are very useful if you want some kind of polarization-sensitive detection or polarization-sensitive filter. And the last four are not polarization-sensitive since they have fourfold symmetry. So those they're basically useful for different applications. And the other thing to notice is having the split gaps either in the center or out on the sides can be useful for different kinds of device applications. So these particular materials, this gold part is metal and the gray part is a dielectric. And the electric field is oriented perpendicular to the gaps. Another set of metamaterials, which are called complementary metamaterials, basically have the structure being a dielectric, the material being a thin film of metal, and they're excited with the magnetic field perpendicular to the gap. So these materials actually have complementary transmission characteristics as in accordance with Babinet's principle. And so, for example, if you take this material here, this is the regular response or the response of the original material, and you basically get a notch filter response for the complementary metamaterial. And these two responses are such that the transmission of the two in electric field adds up to one. And this is all in accordance with Babinet's principle from, say, Born and Wolf. This, actually, again, just to go in a little more detail, so this shows your original metamaterial, your complementary metamaterial. This basically shows a simulation of the electric field in the two and the currents. So these little arrows show how the current in the two, and these colors basically show the electric field. So where you have a high electric field in the original metamaterial, your current is maximum in the complementary metamaterial. And this just shows, the response of the original metamaterial, the response of the complementary metamaterial. So again, we're just sort of, at this point, building up a toolbox of different kinds of metamaterials that we will use a little bit later for different kinds of applications. Another thing to notice is that you have two different responses in these metamaterials. This sharp response here is the main response. It's due to the two opposing currents that are oscillating, the LRC currents. The second response is more a dipolar response over at the side. And for a lot of applications, you'd like to be able to get rid of this or at least tune it away from your main metamaterial response. So if you actually look at different configurations or different geometries with the same area, you can see that this first geometry where these sides are separated by a larger distance from the center, that actually pushes the second resonance out. And if you use this kind of squashed metamaterial, again, with the same area as your original, the resonance moves in. So this kind of gives you another tool for designing your metamaterial response. So you don't actually always have to use metals to form these metamaterials. And this is actually some very recent results where we've actually used a superconductor instead of a metal to form the metamaterial artificial atoms. So this metal here is now optimally doped YBCO with a transition temperature of about 90 Kelvin. And this is more complicated to fabricate, but certainly doable. Just to show you the terahertz response at, say, 50, you have an imaginary part, which basically shows a 1 over omega dependence due to the condensate, and then you have a quasi-particle Drudeau response, which is the real part of the conductivity. So in a regular metal, you basically have this response and then a much smaller imaginary response. If you look at the resonant response of this material as a function of temperature, you can actually see that at low temperatures, it behaves very much like a metamaterial. And as you tune it towards the transition temperature, this goes away. So this is actually very preliminary results. There's a lot more we think we can do with this, but this does show that you can tune this metamaterial by tuning the temperature. Another thing you can do with metamaterials is use them to control polarization. So if you take two different kinds of split ring resonators, this is a circular electric split ring resonator. This is an elliptical, and the reason being that there is total symmetry in this one, and this has a long axis and a short axis. So if you actually take the transmission and as a function of rotation around this axis, you can see that for the circular metamaterial, there's no change, which is what you'd expect. This is totally symmetric. But as you rotate this, you actually rotate from the solid structure to the dotted structure. And you basically get, these are in 30 degree increments, but you get basically a complicated response that moves from the solid response to this dotted response. So what good is this? Well, you can actually use this to design different kinds of polarizing devices in the terahertz regime. So there's really no natural, say, quarter waveplate in the terahertz regime. With this kind of control of polarization, one can use metamaterials to design a quarter waveplate. So if you plot the response at these three frequencies as a function of polarization angle, you get these three different curves. So this is the absolute transmission, and this is the phase as a function of polarization angle at these three frequencies. If you look at this red curve, which is basically at 1 terahertz, you see that as you go from 0 to 90 degrees, you basically get a 45-degree phase shift, and you get a reasonably constant amplitude. So that actually means that if you took two of these together with a dielectric in between, you could have a quarter wave plate because light polarized with a 90-degree phase shift would then shift by 90 degrees. Or light polarized orthogonally would then shift by 90 degrees after transversing this. And so we actually went through the design. It actually shifts if you do the details of this design with a dielectric sandwiched in between, you do get a quarter wave plate. It's actually, its response or resonance frequency is basically 0.9 terahertz rather than 1 terahertz. But this again kind of shows the kind of devices that you can build using metamaterials in the terahertz regime. This is something that would be, very, very thin, like, a micron thickness rather than a bulky kind of quarter wave plate as well. So a final area that I just wanted to touch on in kind of the passive metamaterials design is the concept of using metamaterials for sensing and what kind of limitations one might expect. So one could put if one puts a dielectric, say, in the gap here, that should change the metamaterial response. It should change the frequency, it should change the capacitance, and therefore change the frequency at which the absorption occurs. So this is actually a plot of what happens if you put a 16 micron thick photoresist overlayer. You can see definitely a measurable shift in the frequency. That's a pretty thick overlayer. I mean, if you're going to do biological sensing, that would be, you'd want to be able to sense something more like on the order of 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers. So what we did was really look at what the shift was, both for the primary and secondary metamaterial resonance as a function of thickness. So this is for the primary resonance, this is for the secondary resonance, and this basically shows the frequency response for both of these for different thickness layers. Our conclusions here are that in order to make this real, something that where you could sense nanometer layer or 10 nanometer layer thicknesses of dielectric constants, you need to minimize the substrate, because basically what's happening is the electric field will penetrate into the substrate. If the substrate is too thick, that's what's going to dominate the response, and you won't get much of a shift. So if you thin down the substrate to 10 to 20 nanometers, you can basically detect a minimum layer of about 20 nanometers. This is pretty good. It's probably comparable to or not quite as good as where biological sensing is right now, but this is really just a preliminary view of what you can do with metamaterials and sensing in the terahertz regime. So one final area is, in order to build something like one of these cloaks, or really to understand how metamaterials work, it would be nice to be able to build up a bulk metamaterial, not just one single layer, which is what I've been talking about so far. So in order to do that, we decided to try to fabricate our metamaterials on Kapton substrates. The reason for that is if you had some kind of three-dimensional metamaterial that you wanted to deform or mold into a particular shape, you'd want it on a material that was somewhat flexible. So What I'm going to show you now are layers of metamaterials that have been deposited on 84 micron Kapton substrates and sandwiched between two quartz plates. So if we do that with our first layer of metamaterial, you see the response here. This is the transmission, so you do see a metamaterial absorption peak, and you do see in the phase this little blip here that's due to the metamaterial. And this linear part is just due to the Kapton. Okay, so if you put in another layer, you're enhancing your resonance, and you can keep going. And when you put in five layers, you really have got a stopgap in terms of the transmission. So you've really done something new. You can also extract the dielectric coefficient. And if you do it right, which we believe we've done, then you get a dielectric function that doesn't depend on layer thickness, which is what you would expect. So this is one of the few demonstrations of really building up a metamaterial into a three-dimensional solid, albeit only five layers. The main limitation here is the loss. The loss in these Kapton layers is what's really going to limit one from, say, building up a 100-layer thick kind of metamaterial in three dimensions. So now I'm going to move on to what I think is the more important part of my talk, which is describing our progress in developing active metamaterials. So really using metamaterials and concepts to develop active photonic devices in the terahertz regime. So again, I'm going to begin by describing our experimental technique. I come from an ultrafast optics background. So what we're used to doing is pump probe experiments where we excite a material with a pump pulse and then we probe it at a different frequency. We've actually done a lot of work looking at optical pump terahertz probe, and that's what we're going to start with here. So this is our terahertz setup. This setup, as it's shown here, and I've actually seen this in a couple of labs here already, will just measure the terahertz response as I showed you earlier. If we then add a optical pump pulse, we can excite the material, produce some change in it, and then as a function of delay between this optical excitation pulse and this terahertz pulse, map out the terahertz response of the material. So basically, we excite with a pump laser, as shown here, and then we probe with the terahertz pulse as a function of delay between the pump laser and the terahertz pulse. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the dynamic response of a split ring resonator. So again, if we just look at the split ring resonator, you've got a metallic pattern on a dielectric substrate. If you could perturb the dielectric substrate and change it, for example, from non-conducting to conducting, or the other way around, you will change the property of the metamaterial. So in this case, we've deposited our metallic structure on gallium arsenide, which you can photo-excite with above band gap radiation and change the properties of the material. So before excitation, this is our resonant response. Again, this is the transmission of the electric field. If we then photo, and that's, we can also derive the dielectric constant from the transmission. If we photo-excite it, in particular, if we photo-excite the gap, we can actually photo-excite the gap such that it becomes conducting because you've got basically due to response of the photo-excited carriers in the gap. And what that does is it changes the response of our metamaterial. So if we use as little as half a milliwatt of excitation pulse power, you can see that we basically change the at least the response in the first resonance by about 50%. With milliwatt, we basically killed the first resonance. And if we go up to 10 milliwatts, we've basically killed off both of the other resonances. So this is pretty nice. If you use a short pulse to excite it, you'll get a fast response. However, in gallium arsenide, the recombination time is about a couple of nanoseconds, so you won't be able to refresh your material on a fast time scale. There won't be recovery dynamics that are really fast. Gigahertz, perhaps, but not picoseconds. One can change that by, instead of using plain gallium arsenide, using a semiconductor that has a fast response. So there are a number of semiconductors that fit the bill. Low temperature or radiation damaged silicon on sapphire, low temperature grown gallium arsenide. We've actually chose to use this new material, erbium arsenide doped gallium arsenide nano island super lattices. And what this is basically, this is something that Art Gossard does really well. He puts down these nano islands that are basically traps for the material, but in a very ordered fashion, because this is grown via MBE techniques. So you've got these grown traps, and you can actually vary the super lattice period from, 25 nanometers, 50 nanometers, 100 nanometers, and as you vary the period, you basically design the trapping time. So for a 25 nanometer spacing, the trapping time is about a picosecond. And as you increase the distance between layers, you increase the trapping time or the response time of the super lattice. So what we did was we fabricated our metamaterial on a super lattice that had basically a 100 nanometer repeat. And this gave us a measured response time on the order of 20 picoseconds. If we actually incorporate this into our switch, so under no photo excitation, we basically see a nice resonance. We excite it, and after 2 picoseconds, we see that the resonance has gone away. So this is basically pump probe data, optical pump terahertz probe. So you can actually see that after on the order of 10 to 20 picoseconds, the resonance is fully recovered. So we've been able to design in this material a fast response. We've got basically an amplitude modulator that's both fast in its initiation and fast in its recovery on the order of 10 picoseconds. Another thing one can do in terms of tuning the metamaterial response is to tune the frequency of the response. The way you do that is you either tune the capacitance or the inductance of the metamaterial. So the metamaterial response frequency is basically proportional to 1 over the square root of the inductance times the capacitance. So if you increase the capacitance, say by increasing the area, you can decrease the response frequency. Similarly, you can do the same thing by increasing or decreasing the inductance. The way we're going to do this is basically through photo excitation. And that, so basically we're trying to get tunability via optical excitation. Our focus will be on a capacitively tuned resonance, because you're also, when you do this optical excitation, introducing increased resistance, you're introducing increased disorder. This tends to have more of an effect on the resonances in an inductively tuned material than in a capacitively tuned material. It basically works better to tune the capacitance. So this was actually a pretty complicated design. Let me just go back here. So what the design for this material is this gold part is the metal in this optically tunable metamaterial. And the silver part is basically a semiconductor. It's going to be silicon. We're going to photo-excite the silicon, and we're basically going to induce a phase change, a structural phase change in this metamaterial. So this is a little bit complicated to make. So I'm just going to go through the fabrication, since I haven't spent a lot of time on the fabrication. So you take silicon on sapphire substrate that you really don't want to excite. You spin photoresist on it. You use photolithography to define the split ring resonators. So you see the split ring resonators that we've defined don't have this little capacitive edge. We're going to put that on with silicon. You do metallization and liftoff, and you spin the photoresist. And then you use photolithography to define the silicon capacitor regions. That's why we have the silicon layer on top of the sapphire laser layer. You do reactive ion etch to remove the unwanted silicon and remove the photoresist. And then you have basically a structure that looks like this. So this is an SEM of our structure. Again, this is the main structure. And then these little bars here are what we're going to photo-excite. And this is an SEM image showing that these are about 50 microns in scale. So our terahertz wave goes across many of these. Our terahertz wave is about 300 microns in length. So in terms of the performance, before we pump, we basically have a response that looks like this. This is our resonance that's at about 1 terahertz. As we start to photoexcite at relatively low fluences, we're just wrecking this resonance. So what we're doing is we haven't, the silicon hasn't gone conductive yet, but it's more disordered because we've done this photoexcitation. It's at a higher temperature. So we basically increased the resistance and basically made our response worse. As we go to higher and higher fluences, we begin to see the conductivity kick in and we're shifting the resonance frequency. And then at high enough fluences, which is actually pretty high, 500 milliwatts, we see a shift in the frequency and the resonance really form. One can model this response, and it actually is pretty similar to what we see in the experiment, which makes us feel good. And we've demonstrated a frequency tunability of about 20%. The other thing I'd like to say is that this kind of a change as a function of fluence looks like the change of that you'd see in a diffraction peak as you go through a structural phase transition, which is again, I believe, what we're inducing in this metamaterial. Alternative designs include changing the inductance by basically fabricating semiconductors that you can optically excite across the split ring resonator. If you model this, you get 30% tunability. In practice, it's a lot harder to make this work because it's such a large region that you have to excite, and you're going to degrade the performance by inducing disorder. One can also think of some kind of meandering structure that you then photoexcite. And if you do this, you again get tunability. In these two cases, the resonance frequency increases rather than decreases because you're decreasing the inductance. So now I'm going to shift from from devices where you're able to change the functionality through optical excitation to, I would say, a more practical set of devices where you can change the function due to electric charge injection. So the first thing I'm going to discuss here is our terahertz electrical switch. So let me just... The idea here is if you are able to shunt off the capacitance, you can actually change the response electrically of the split ring resonator. The way we do that is we have the split ring resonator or the metamaterial deposited on doped gallium arsenide. So when you have zero bias here, you basically have a conductor across here and very little metamaterial response. If you apply a voltage here, you basically deplete the charges from this area. It becomes an insulator, and your metamaterial resonance appears. So this is the structure that I'm talking about. This basically shows an SEM of the structure and gives you a little bit of an idea of how you do the fabrication. This is not as complicated as the frequency tunable metamaterial that I showed earlier. The big issue here is trying to make the ohmic contact and the pads as small as possible to reduce the total capacitance, because this actually limits the speed of response of this metamaterial. For this first demonstration that I'm going to show, and this kind of a structure, that was not optimized at all. So again, we're using terahertz spectroscopy to diagnose the response of this modulator or this switch, this device. If we have zero voltage across the device, and we take a terahertz transmission spectra. We see very little response. So again, the E field is oriented across the gap. And this is the real part of the dielectric constant derived from these transmission, the transmittivity, the complex transmittivity. So as we increase the voltage, we can see that the resonance comes in to play. So we've basically depleted enough charge that we do have a conductor on top of a dielectric. We've tuned the real part of the dielectric constant from positive at 0 volts to negative. And we're able to demonstrate a terahertz switching efficiency. This is an intensity of about 50%, which is a pretty good modulator. In contrast, in the spectral range, one can use quantum cascade lasers to do some kinds of modulation. Those operate at very low temperatures, and they're not very efficient. So the kinds of modulations one can get in the terahertz is typically, before this was demonstrated, about 5%. We're switching epsilon between positive and negative. And for this particular device, we demonstrated a modulation. We could modulate up to 200 kilohertz. In a next generation device that I don't think I have time to show you, we were able to achieve 2 megahertz modulation frequencies. Now, that's not great, but it's not bad. And I think, you know, if one really works at reducing the capacitance of the material, then one can get even higher modulation frequencies. So what I showed you there was just a single modulator. One can actually put these modulators into an array, as we've done in collaboration with Dan Mittelman at Rice University, and make a terahertz spatial light modulator, which is really something that is not, that does not exist prior to this work. So this shows 4x4 pixels. Each pixel is 4 millimeters in space, and that includes a lot of, so 4 millimeters is enough that it includes a lot of little slit ring resonators, a lot of little metamaterial atoms, and each of these pixels is individually addressable. Each of them shows a response. So the red curve is the switched off response, so that basically has more transmission than the switched on response, and you can see that the contrast is very good. This metamaterial device was optimized to work at about 0.35 terahertz. And a final demonstration, we basically put the modulator in a configuration where we have a slit. So light can go through the white parts and not through the black parts and or the gray parts. So in the far field, you see this pattern from basically diffraction through a double slit configuration. And you can actually change the width of the split of the slit, or the distance between the slits, and you see a change in the pattern, as you'd expect from calculations. So this is working nicely, and this is something that we're about to develop. You know, 4x4 is maybe a little bit marginal. We're trying to go to 16x16 in terms of a real spatial modulator device. Another area that we've used this ability to switch electrically our metamaterial is in studying the resonances in the near field. So in collaboration with Roland Kirsten at University of Munich, we basically sent him our terahertz metamaterials, and he has a near field terahertz probe, which he's used to study the response of these materials. The important part of this probe is it's got a terahertz time domain spectroscopy source, which provides the terahertz radiation. But the near field basically comes from this sharp probe, which is capacitively coupled to the material and enables you to measure things on a scale less than your terahertz wavelength. So you can see responses, say, on a micron spatial scale, whereas your wave has a spatial scale of, say, 300 microns to a millimeter. So if one just does imaging of this material, one can image it in the terahertz and get reasonably good contrast and, as I said, micron scale resolution. So this is 10 microns, and you can see that you really do have pretty good resolution. But what's even more powerful is to do differential near-field imaging, where you basically turn the voltage on and off, and you try to image where the charge is. So this is a near-field image of the metamaterial when exciting it near the gap. You can actually do this in a spectrally resolved manner. So if we excite the metamaterial in the gap, we see actually both of the responses. This particular material has a response of around 0.7 terahertz and about 1.5 terahertz. You see both of those responses when you excite it near the gap. If you excite it along the edges, you see neither of them. That's this flat curve here. So basically, they're most effectively, one conclusion from this is that these resonances are most effectively excited when you excite in the capacitive region. This is a little bit curious because up till now, people thought that the high-frequency response, at least, was due to dipolar-type oscillations along the sides. And so you would think you'd be able to couple along the sides and see that resonance, couple in the center and see the low-frequency resonance. This led us to do another study where we basically changed the periodicity of the material. And we saw that the second dipolar resonance changed as we changed the periodicity of the material, so that this response, this higher frequency response, is not a true metamaterial response, but rather a collective response of, due to surface plasmons. That is the conclusion we're coming to. I don't think we've totally pinned this down. But this first response is definitely the response due to the two circulating currents, and it is not dependent on the periodicity of the material, how far apart they're spaced. The second resonance, we are beginning to believe, is due to a more collective response of the material rather than a real metamaterial response. So my final design that I'm going to describe is, again, going back to this electrically switchable metamaterial that I talked about, with a slightly different design. So earlier I had shown you all of these different designs of metamaterial filters, and I said that some of them are more efficient for certain applications and some for others. It turns out that if you want to do electrical modulation of the metamaterial, it's better if you can put your split gaps, put your gaps out, not in the center, but out towards the edges of the ring. This enables them to couple more effectively to the ohmic contacts, and it allows you to make a larger modulation of the signal. So that's actually what we did in this particular design. And if we look at the response, we see that we get a maximum amplitude modulation in electric field of 50%, which translates to 76% amplitude modulation and intensity. And that's like a factor of 50% better than, say, when the split gaps were in the center. But more importantly, when we did this work, we also noticed that we were not only getting amplitude modulation, but we were also getting phase modulation. Now, this shouldn't have been a surprise for us, but in fact it was. And where your phase modulation is maximum, your amplitude modulation is minimum, and vice versa. So you really can separate out an amplitude modulator from a phase modulator. And this is just your phase modulation is basically the derivative with respect to frequency of your amplitude modulation. So the other thing that we noticed is that the phase shift is linear with applied voltage. So this makes this kind of a device attractive for a number of reasons. It actually shows that the modulation is much more broadband than we thought. So if you combine the phase and amplitude modulation, as I'll show you in the next slide, you really are able to modulate over a terahertz frequency range, which is pretty significant. It's not just a resonance effect. And the second thing is, because you have a linear change in phase with voltage, you can make this into a terahertz phase modulator. Again, that's something that that's a device that is not currently available in any form. So again, this is a new device that will enable terahertz technology. So as I mentioned earlier, this effect does allow broadband modulation. So if you take delta T and you take the absolute value of that, you can actually, this is the 2 terahertz waveforms that we measured. This is the modulated form in the reference. And then if you calculate this quantity and plot it, you basically see that your modulation amplitude is reasonably flat from about half a terahertz up to 1.5 terahertz. So you could use this as a chopper, and that's just what we did. Most of our terahertz data is taken with a mechanical chopper. You can go up to a few kilohertz, and you know it just does just fine, but it is a mechanical chopper. If we compare that to, instead, using our metamaterial, which we can chop at frequencies up to tens of kilohertz, we can see that there isn't a whole lot of difference. In other words, we can get we can really replace our mechanical chopper by this little piece of gallium arsenide with some metal deposited on it, which really does make a compact chopper. Now, of course, there are problems with this. You know, a chopper, you can get all of the light through. It doesn't absorb any of them. The metamaterial is not perfect in that respect. But still, it shows, I think, a lot of promise in terms of a compact chopper that you could drive electrically rather than having moving parts and things like that. And it does have the ability to go up to much higher frequencies, say, than a mechanical chopper. So with that, I'll conclude my talk. I really do think that metamaterials offer a lot of promise for the future in terms of optical control in a variety of wavelength regions. They enable one to make devices and look at processes that one couldn't look at previously. So I think that's really important. And before I close, I would just like to acknowledge that a lot of this work was done at the Center for Integrated Nanotechnologies, which is a DOE nanoscience center located in New Mexico. It actually hosts a user program, and so if anybody is interested in using SINT, as it's called, to fabricate nanomaterials, to characterize nanomaterials, synthesize nanomaterials, you can either talk to me, or you can look at the SINT website and see if there's a capability that you're interested in. Thank you for your attention.